All right. And we're rolling. Hi, this is Mark Goldberg with the United Nations Affairs blog, UN Dispatch. I'm talking today with Mr. Jim Murphy, who's a British Member of Parliament and the British Minister for European Affairs. He's also the co-author of a new publication called Engagement, Public Diplomacy in a Globalized World. Mr. Murphy, thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Well, thanks. So I guess maybe first questions first. You're only about a mile away from where I am right now at the British Embassy here in Washington. What is the British Minister for European Affairs doing in the States this week?
Well, don't worry. You haven't woken up today and discovered that the US is part of the European Union. I'm also, as well as being the Minister for Europe, I'm also the UK Minister for Public Diplomacy. That's what brings me to the US. Early in the week, I was in California, Utah, New York, and now Washington. So it's a public—it's the public diplomacy part of my job that I'm in the US over. It's got nothing to do with the EU.
Directly. And so what now I read now you're also the Foreign Office has its own blog, and I've been reading your blog post, and you're in Utah recently as well. Sort of, were you promoting your new publication?
Well, really, it was a part of the UK's differing approach to public diplomacy is that there are a number of strategic priorities for the UK in foreign policy. Climate change is one of them, one of the four most important strategic priorities for the UK. And the issue there is that how do we build up relationships at state level as well as federal level? So I was there, I met the governor, and we had a great conversation about the work that he's doing and the leadership that he is genuinely providing. And then I met some other politicians, and what I found interesting was that some of the politicians I met were of the view that the climate change campaign about us all acting responsibly towards our planet was part of some wider liberal conspiracy against conservative America. Now, that's not an argument I'd heard before. It's not an argument that we have in any of the 27 democracies of the European Union, but it was great to hear it because, like, you've got to understand the world as other people see it in modern public diplomacy. Yeah. So rather than trying to criticise that view, try to understand it and convince them otherwise through time.
Yeah, so I mean, what did you sort of, were you armed with facts and figures yourself? Or it seems that it might be difficult coming from a foreigner to be convinced of these arguments, but how did you sort of do your best?
Well, I'm not sure we convinced one another. I certainly didn't come out of Utah thinking that climate change was part of a liberal conspiracy against Utah or against conservative America. And I say, there's some great politicians in Utah. The governor in particular, the mayor of Salt Lake City, who are very, very active on climate change. It's part of a continuing conversation. What is it we can do to try and convince others? What concerns do they have? There are particular concerns in Utah about fossil fuel, coal mining and things like that. There are the worries about industry and worries about jobs. Now, the main thing we can do there, I think, is to try and support those people who are concerned about jobs in the coal industry to say two things. One, that we can help make coal clean energy by carbon capture so there can still be a future for the coal industry. And secondly, those countries and states here in the US who are early adopters of climate change technologies can really have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of green-collar jobs. There's another era of a different type of industrial revolution fueled by concerns about climate change. And the UK is determined to have many more hundreds of thousands of people working in green-collar jobs, as well as blue-collar jobs and white-collar jobs. But the real growth will be in green-collar jobs, and that's a message, I think, that applies in the UK, and it applies in Utah as well.
I guess, you know, when sort of we look at the sort of the international climate change debate here in the United States, and I'm actually wanting to get your sort of impression from abroad. It seems that there's a lot of hope placed in the next administration because both candidates are, you know, on record sort of disagreeing with the folks that you met in Utah that climate change, you know, is a serious problem and, you know, worthy of international action. Now, sort of Kyoto is set to expire in 2012, and we have the Copenhagen Agreement that is set to sort of hopefully take over after that. Do you see the United States sort of joining these agreements and signing up for Copenhagen anytime soon in the next administration?
Well, I think there are some very positive signs about the remarkable change in attitudes here in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Attitudes have changed in the European Union and the UK as well over the past decade. A greater realisation of the problem and the urgency of the problem. In fact, I think there are something like 33 states of the US who are actively working on climate change in a really coordinated way. When I was in California and Utah, I heard an awful lot about the Western Governors Association's work and the Western Climate Initiative. So there's a real cause for optimism about the scale of work that is now going on. Now, in terms of Copenhagen, the meeting in Copenhagen in 2009, like, we just have to get an agreement there. It isn't a matter of should we or shouldn't we. We must. And the European Union, with the UK playing a very leading role, and let's remember, the European Union is the largest rules-based free market in human history. But the European Union, really, our intention is to show leadership on this, to try and get an agreement over this year rather than 2009, so that we show global leadership as Europe, to say to other countries, other groups of countries in other regions, this is the right thing to do. It's good, it's the responsible thing to do, but it's also the profitable thing to do, because this is going to be the great growth area in employment over the future decades. Climate change, environmental-related jobs, and certainly one of the messages for people in the US is that Europe means business on this. We will be early adopters of this climate change technologies, generating green cars, home insulation, wind and renewable powers. And there's an enormous market, and Europe's going to be a big player in that market, generating millions of jobs across the continent.
Mm-hmm. Can you sort of tell us a little bit about sort of this book, this publication that you just put out, Engagement, Public Diplomacy in a Globalized World?
Well, we published this book in Washington this week, and we'll also launch in London. And the concept here is that the world has changed irreversibly, and so must public diplomacy. The world's changed in a number of different ways. One is that the issues such as climate change, terrorism, nature of statehood, and the dangers of failed states, all of these things are interlinked as never before. These joined up problems need coherent and joined up solutions. Secondly, is that people have become more powerful across the planet. Of course there are places where there are despots and non-democracies, but increasingly democracy and more powerful people and more powerful citizens and more demanding citizens is the norm across the world. And those two, plus the ability of technology to communicate, exchange and campaign ideas, messages and energies instantly across the globe, really means public diplomacy has to catch up. Firstly, what public diplomacy can't just be about messaging. It can't just be about propaganda. It can't be about shouting your message ever more loudly in the hope that if you just shout, people will listen more carefully. It's about, in fact, communication, and as we all know, communication involves both speaking but also listening. And I think we've got to do a little bit more of that listening to other people's concerns, listening to their worries, understanding their culture, understanding their motivations. And in that context, I think we can have a much more kind of successful public diplomacy, because it's a public diplomacy that's created jointly with those that we want to work with. So, again, on climate change, we've got to try and get a greater understanding of really the worries that people have across the planet on counter-radicalisation. It's important to try and understand the world from other people's shoes, and it's also important to try and work out strategies for saying, look, if someone doesn't have shoes, what's in it for them to act responsibly on climate change or in counter-radicalisation? So it's a sense that public diplomacy isn't just about government to government. Of course, that bilateralism and multilateral government to government relationships are of fundamental importance. But the citizens of different countries are also active players in this modern public diplomacy. They cannot just be passive recipients of a message.
We'll put a link to the report up on the site. here. I wanted to maybe get your take on a few sort of European issues, ones that are, you know, ones that particularly don't get much play here in the United States. The first is the Lisbon Treaty. This really did not get really much attention at all, but it was you know, all I think Europe was talking about for much of the month of June. I was hoping maybe you could sort of explain to our viewers sort of what the Lisbon Treaty is and what happened in Ireland just a couple of weeks ago.
Okay. Well, that's a big question to try and explain what is the Lisbon Treaty and what happened in Ireland, but I'll do that in just 1 minute if you don't mind.
Okay.
The Lisbon Treaty, by its name, was a treaty signed and agreed in Lisbon, in Portugal. And what happens at the moment is the 27 democracies of the European Union operate under a set of rules. It's a set of rules that really are pretty outdated, because the European Union has grown so much. When the UK joined the European Union in the 1970s, there were only 6 countries in membership of Europe. There are now 27. A remarkable growth, with Central and Eastern European countries now joining. This great success story that is the European Union. But any organisation that grows at that speed needs modern rules and needs to change its structures. The Lisbon Treaty really is about trying to modernise the European structures, make Europe an even more active player in the world stage on some of the issues that we've spoken about. Now, one of the rules of the European Union is that for any new treaty, like the Lisbon Treaty, to come into force, all 27 countries have to agree it. Ireland is the only country in Europe that has to have, because of its constitution, to have a referendum of its people. They had a referendum a short time ago, and they voted no. So really, the treaty cannot progress until all 27 countries agree it. So it's really in abeyance at the moment, until such time as the Irish government are able to suggest a way forward. So in a minute or two, that's the Lisbon Treaty. But the purpose of it is really to make Europe much more effective by modernising the rules. And the people watching and listening to this probably are not involved in any organisation where the leadership of it changes every 6 months. But the European Union does exactly that. Every 26 weeks, a different country, becomes the president of the European Union Council. Now, that's no way to organise such a remarkable organisation that does so much good in the world. It's the biggest donor of international aid on the planet. But it's good, but it could be great, and it could be better. And that's why the Lisbon Treaty is an important part of it.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the sort of Lisbon Treaty was almost sort of created as in a response to the sort of the failure of the sort of French and Dutch to ratify the sort of European Constitution in 2005, is that right? And this is sort of the successor attempt?
Yeah, the idea was that to have an all-encompassing constitution for the European Union, for the countries of the European Union, for the European Union. Referendums took place, as you say, in France and the Netherlands. They voted no. There was a period whereby we reflected and we came up with a more modest treaty.
And why sort of in your opinion, did the sort of Irish voters reject the Lisbon Treaty?
Well, I think it's always difficult for a politician to second-guess the motivation of the public, particularly the public of another country. People have their own reasons. I hope this doesn't sound too blasé, but the Irish voted against it for everything and for nothing. There's many reasons and many concerns that people had. The interesting thing, though, was that the publicly stated concerns were about abortion, independence of Irish policy on abortion, Irish tax system, and Irish international neutrality, which they understandably guard very carefully. None of those things are affected by the Lisbon Treaty. So it's difficult to work out, because none of those things have anything to do with the Lisbon Treaty. So I think we've just got to get smarter at understanding people's concerns.
Yeah.
And it comes back to public diplomacy.
Yeah.
If we'd known beforehand these were the concerns of the Irish people, perhaps we should have been able to listen to that, all of us in Europe, and act more carefully.
It seems that, you know, one might say it was a failure of public diplomacy, and it's good to see that, you know, you're sort of doing what you can to sort of recast public diplomacy going forward.
Yeah, but the long wrong lesson from public diplomacy is to turn around to the Irish people and say, you're wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a temptation for some, but that's just the wrong way to do this. We've got to go a period of listening and taking on board their concerns. Of course, there is the difficulty because the treaty contains nothing, doesn't actually contain any of any substance to motivate these concerns. But I'm confident we'll find a way through this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing I found curious, you know, when sort of doing what I could to follow sort of the debate in Ireland was that sort of we had sort of our former UN ambassador John Bolton travel to Ireland to sort of articulate sort of his objections to the treaty. Do you know what those sort of objections were?
No, John's got his own particular concerns about how the world's running. I'll leave John to be a spokesman for himself.
That's a very diplomatic answer, sir.
I find it hard enough to be a spokesman for myself. I'll leave John Bolton's comments for him.
Maybe, I guess the other sort of big issue, you know, that sort of we in the United States, when we project upon sort of the future of Europe, is this idea of Turkish ascension to the EU. Sir, under what circumstances, I guess, do you see that happening? I guess, and how do you, as sort of a master of public diplomacy, sort of convince the people of Europe or engage the people of Europe in this conversation?
Well, first of all, the UK strongly, very strongly supports Turkish membership of the European Union. We think it'll be good for our economies. We think it's great for our cultures. And we think it's strategically important for Europe that Turkey would be a member of the European Union. But there's a long way to go. And there's two major things we've got to do. You rightly say that we've got to convince European publics that this is the right thing to do. And again, that takes time. This can't be a big bang. It's got to be a gradual process about how every time the European Union has increased in size, it's been good for us. So really, the argument is to say this is in Britain's interest. It's progressive self-interest. Let's do the right thing. But let's do the right thing because it's good for us. So that sense of progressive self-interest. But then in Turkey, they've got to change as well. We're not talking about the Turkey of today joining the European Union, or even the Turkey of tomorrow. It's a Turkey, a radically changed Turkey, a Turkey where democracy is embedded, where the economy is a open and free market, where human rights are respected. But this government in Turkey really is making substantial progress. Membership of the European Union is about whether you fit the rules of the European Union. If Turkey reforms and meets the standards of membership, then it should join. I think it's good for Turkey, good for Britain, good for Europe, and it says something very powerful, that Europe can have a predominantly Muslim, albeit secular, but predominantly Muslim country at the heart of Europe, and that really gives Europe a strategic reach which we don't have at the moment, so it's very important for our long-time interests as well.
I wonder, sir, to what extent do you think xenophobic attitudes might sort of stall sort of Turkish ascension to the EU? I mean, is a referendum required in any country? Is a referendum required in, say, Ireland to accept Turkish ascension to the EU?
Well, the one referendum that we think is necessary at the moment is in France, where President Sarkozy, I think, has got a policy whereby any country that joins the European Union that increases the population of the European Union by 5% or more would require a referendum. So there's a lot of convincing to go on there, but I think it's a medium-term challenge. It's not something that we have to resolve tomorrow. The important thing is, let's see if Turkey matches up to its responsibilities. If Turkey does all the big things that they're asked to do, democratization, embedding that democracy, really being an open and free market, protecting human rights and diversity, and all the things that kind of the good and great democracies of the world now take for granted, and they're making real progress in Turkey. So if that progress continues, I don't understand the logic that says this country cannot join. If they fulfill all of our standards, then we should welcome them into what I think is the most successful economic, democratic bloc anywhere on the planet.
Well, I guess from your lips to the sort of voters and the French voters' ears and hands to pull the lever. Sir, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're just out of time. I would encourage viewers to check out your blog and also check out your new book, Engagement: Public Diplomacy in a Globalized World. Thank you so much.
Great talking to you. Thank you for posting the book on your site. That's really very helpful. And I'd be fascinated to hear back some feedback from your viewers and anyone else who's involved. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, but I tell you, it's a very active sort of viewer comment thread. So I would recommend you might weigh in there yourself if you
I'll keep an eye on it, and I'll intervene on it as well. I'll definitely do that. Okay, cheers.
All right, thank you so much, Mr. Minister. Bye-bye.
Bye.